I'm Mark Simpson, and this is Intersection. The Orlando Ballet starts its new season this week, and they're bringing back the dark and campy Vampire's Ball. It's a production of blood-sucking ballerinas wearing glow-in-the-dark fangs. Artistic director Robert Hill joins me to discuss the ballet's new season, which also includes productions of The Nutcracker and Carmina Burana. Plus, construction is underway on the new Downtown Performing Arts Center, but local organist Turi Larson says something's missing from the plans, a pipe organ. That's ahead on Intersection. The Orlando Ballet begins its new season October 19th with the run of the dark and haunting Vampire's Ball, but the season also includes more traditional favorites like The Nutcracker and Carmina Burana. Also, Robert Hill, the Orlando Ballet's artistic director, is here to talk with us about it. Robert, great to have you here.
It's great to be here.
So this is kind of an interesting mix. I mean, vampires, ballerinas, maybe not what we typically think of going together, but Vampire Ball last season was a really great selling show for you, and it features pop songs, eclectic music. So how do vampires and ballet fit together?
Well, a lot of ballet companies have done, Dracula, you know, they've tried to do it, and some to... not such a great success. It seemed that we always have this October period where Orlando Ballet has the Bob Carr booked. So I decided, let's see. Okay, let me explore something because I'm a creative type and I'm a choreographer. And I started to go into Vampire's Ball. I painted over the title. And it's actually a very camp. I don't take any of it seriously. I don't take this sort of it's entertaining. It pokes fun at ballet, and it gives it's an opportunity for great dancing. So that's kind of how it works.
How much of it is about vampires, and how much of it is about dance?
I want to say it's pretty much all about dance. We have the vampiress and the vampire whose ball it is. We have a group of corps de ballet, which is the undeads. We have the mad scientist, who's a genius, actually. One of our dancers, Doug Horn, an absolute genius, this sort of crazy doctor who creates one of the other characters, which is called the experiment. And so he sort of turns into this hunchback. It's pretty camp, and they all have to dance a lot. So it's dance-driven.
Do you think this taps into this whole vampire craze?
Of course.
I mean, we're seeing vampires everywhere now.
Of course,
right?
That's kind of why we did it.
And so what's been the response?
Well, it's backed by popular demand. So pretty good response. You know, the thing is, there's sections. I took music from Giselle. I took music from La Bayadere. And if you are a real balletomane and know those ballets, I've heard people out there just LOL, as they say, you know? I mean, because it's poking fun, and they no, I can't believe you did that, but yes, I did, and people love it. So,
what about in terms of the costuming? Are there definitely fangs?
Yes, actually.
Can you see the fangs, though, from the audience?
Well, it's interesting because the guy who made them for us is a dentist. His name is Paul Skomsky. You may know who he is. Great guy. And he made them last year, and he's also my dentist. So I was in there the other day.
And he said, you need some fangs.
No, he said, we need to take the ones that we did last year and make them bigger, and I need to add some colors to them, maybe some blood dripping off. So we do, and I think this year they'll be even more visible than they were last year.
Very good. We're talking with Robert Hill. He's the artistic director of the Orlando Ballet, and you're listening to Intersection on 90.7 WMFE-FM. Now, talk to me a little bit about what's happening at the Orlando Ballet, because people who might not be following this might not know. There's a transition going on right now. Mark Huff, the ballet's executive director, is leaving 4 months after he joined the ballet. He's going back to his alma mater at the University of North Carolina School for the Arts. And you worked with him in the 1980s at the American Ballet Theater. You were a dancer, but this leaves the ballet kind of in a questioning spot. You don't have an executive director.
Right. And, you know, we managed before Mark got here, and we will manage with Mark gone. He wasn't here long enough to become such a irreplaceable part of the organization. I mean, we got the core group that we have, Catherine Fabian, Deirdre Miles Berger, my assistant, Joey Lynn, you know, we're in the black, and we did that, you know. So essentially, we've got a plan in mind to continue to move forward in a very positive way. So I think that, you know, for the short term, people are looking at it like, oh, the poor ballet, the poor ballet. You know, I was at Headdress Ball the other day and saw a lot of people, and they come, oh, the poor thing. And I know we're not. We're actually pretty good, you know. We're actually doing very well. So we'll manage.
Now, you mentioned that the ballet is doing good. I mean, 5.5 years ago, though, you were $500,000 in debt. So, I mean, you've been able to pull through some really tough economic times to do it. How did it go? How did you make it happen?
By not spending money. 3.5 years ago, January will be 4 years when I arrived here. Yeah, we found out that we were $600,000 in debt. So what do you do? We're in a recession, right? So you
and,
don't...
And numerous arts organizations in town folding up.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to pat myself on the back here. I think that the company was very fortunate to bring me in as the artistic director because I can stage the classics, having danced all of them, and I am also a choreographer. So typically, artistic directors bring in stagers to stage Sleeping Beauty, Swan Lake, whatever, or create new programs, or bring in Twyla Tharp, or bring in a Balanchine program or something like that, all of which costs money. It costs money for licensing fees. It costs money for the people have to fly in. You have to put them up at a hotel. You have to rent a car for them. You have to give them per diem. It's a huge expense. So we think about how many people we didn't have to hire over the course of 3.5 years. It's a lot of money saved.
Wearing multiple hats.
Now, I don't want to do that forever, certainly not, because I think the company needs to have more of an identity than just Robert Hill's choreography. And that was not my mission when I came here, but it was the only way out or go away. The company, you know, and I didn't want the company to go away. So that's how we did it.
So the new Performing Arts Center, the first phase of construction is scheduled to be finished in 2 years. And there's plans for a second phase of construction that call for a theater that the Orlando Ballet and Philharmonic Orchestra are going to be able to use. What's the update on those fronts? What are you hearing and what are you looking forward to?
I'm looking forward to it opening. I'm looking forward to construction being completed and getting in there to perform. I understand that it's no longer phase one and phase two. So that's also very exciting to look forward to. I think they're planning for it all to be done at the same time.
What are you going to get that you're not having right now at the Bob Carr?
Hopefully a theater that has a less number of negative aspects in terms of sight lines, in terms of, I think one of the things about the Bob Carr is that there's no center aisle. I mean, I'm talking from the perspective of the public, you know.
Acoustics?
I think the sound will, you know, until it's actually done, it's hard to,
but are
to say.
I mean, are you disappointed with the sound at the Bob Carr?
I think it can be better, certainly. Especially when we have the recorded music, you would think that the sound system could be a little bit more updated. With the live music, it's not the most acoustically brilliant hall. Yeah, I know you've heard that from several different sources. So yeah, until it's done, we're not really sure, but we're hoping for this glorious new space.
The new season also includes music from The Nutcracker and Carmina Burana, which is a cantata by Carl Orff, and it's very dramatic music. O Fortuna, you're going to be dancing to this. Talk to me about this dance and what's it like taking it through production. Do you have to approach it differently?
Differently than?
Than, say, The Nutcracker.
Oh, it's very different from The Nutcracker, especially because I'm going to be taking a very contemporary take on it, you know. And because I'm currently busy with Vampire's Ball, there we go into Nutcracker, and I've got to do Hollywood on Point first. I'm not really in my sort of front of my brain focusing on Carmina Burana, but it's the kind of thing, it's in the back kind of percolating. It's different than anything else I've done. It's a very important score.
It's really dramatic.
Yeah.
And I wonder, we think of ballet and we think the very languid lines and sensuality in the dancing, but this is really aggressive music. I mean, it's not the Rite of Spring, but it's no sit back in your seat.
That's a good comparison, not necessarily a comparison, but, you know, couple it with that kind of idea. I've seen, again, a lot of different versions, choreographic versions of Rite of Spring. Yeah, there's going to be a lot of very aggressive physicality in Carmina, definitely. I've used some of the songs from Carmina in other works. The first Battle of the Sexes, we used O Fortuna section and another short little section. O Fortuna is the famous, TV commercials and movies use it all the time.
It's everywhere.
Yeah, it's everywhere. So it's not going to be a sort of a clear narrative driven piece. I think it's going to be segments, and I just think that somehow they're all going to relate to each other, and there's going to be a resolve at the end, and I'm not really sure specifically how.
So we're listening to recorded music of this, and the ballet is dancing to recorded music in recent performances, yes?
Yes, but not this time with Carmina.
Yeah. So what's the difference between having that orchestra there to give you the bump versus dancing with a recording? Do you really get the energy off the orchestra?
Well, I think, yeah, I want to come back to that, but with this piece in particular, we're going to have a full orchestra in the pit, and we're going to have like 160 voices all on scaffolding, the whole backdrop of the stage. It's not going to be some pretty backdrop. It's going to be all singers. So you think you've got all that energy coming out of the pit, all that energy coming off the stage, and the dancing is right in the center of it. Ugh, I get goosebumps just thinking about it. Seriously. And then, you know, for example, Nutcracker. Coming back to it, you say, oh, God, can we do this? Can I deal with this another year? But, you know, then I listen to that snow music, the end of first act, and it is glorious. I mean, it's Tchaikovsky, what a genius. So you think that these were first done in a time when there was no recorded music, you know, and first performances with ballet companies was no recorded music. So we have to do it with live orchestra. And so we are bringing back the Philharmonic this year.
Now, here's my question, though, for your Nutcracker production. To me, one way you can always judge a Nutcracker production is by the Rat King. And it is, here's my judgment call, make of it what you will. Are you going to have a three-headed Rat King, or are we just going with a single head? Because I remember when I was young, I saw it in Boston at the Wang Theater.
Mm-hmm.
Three-headed Rat King. That's awesome.
That, like, blew your mind.
Yeah. So what's going on with the Rat King?
We hadn't really talked about it, but, you know, I'm going to take a note look at wardrobe. I mean, I've seen Rat Kings with like nine heads. You ever seen that?
No, but yeah. I mean, more heads the better, right?
I'm definitely going to say, okay, I'm very close to making a promise to you, sir.
Very good. Well, Robert Hill is the Orlando Ballet's artistic director. Their season getting ready to start October 19th. It's been great to talk to you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Up next, the case for a pipe organ in downtown Orlando's new Performing Arts Center. Construction is underway on a new downtown Performing Arts Center in Orlando. And Turi Larson says there's something important missing, though, from the construction plans. That is a pipe organ. Turi Larson is former dean of the American Guild of Organists, known as the AGO. He's also an organist at the Cathedral Church of St. Luke in downtown Orlando, where we caught up with him. Turi, good to talk to you.
Happy to meet you.
So, construction plans for downtown's new Performing Arts Center include a performance hall that would be used for the Orlando Ballet and Philharmonic Orchestra, but you're saying there's something missing, an organ. Why is that?
When I saw the unveiling of the building, to me it was as important as seeing a kitchen in house plans. I saw that there were no plans for a pipe organ. And I asked the acoustician as well as the architect president, I believe. And he said, well, there is no plans for a pipe organ. Well, my spirit dropped because we have, in the Central Florida chapter of American Guild of Organists, 118 members that are committed to seeing that there is a true pipe organ. Major halls in the United States have pipe organs.
What are some of the ones that you think of when you...
Well, many of our major cities have world-class centers, and so naturally, along with that goes pipe organs. In particular, let me mention Disney Hall in Los Angeles, the Davies Hall in San Francisco, Orchestra Hall in Chicago, the Helzberg Hall in Kansas City. And by the way, Helzberg Hall in Kansas City was not going to have an organ. And one lady called up and she says, oh, yes, you are. And she came up with the check. And, of course, the provision was made.
Now, what is it, though, about a pipe organ that is so crucial?
Well, Mozart said that the pipe organ is the king of instruments. It can produce all kinds of sounds, from the highest to the lowest. As a matter of fact, it can produce sounds lower than what the orchestra can do. So you're missing some of the real bottom qualities of sound. The pipe organ can be a centerpiece in a hall. I went to the Nashville AGO convention, and right there in front of us in the concert hall was a pipe organ, and we heard an organ concerto. Well, what would that be without the organ? I have just looked at it this morning, a list of over 400 compositions that can be used with organ and orchestra. And I have another list for band and organ, and another list for ensembles and organ. Now, think of this, 400 compositions that we would be cheated on by not having an organ there. Sure, we go to Epcot Center and we hear the Saint-Saëns Organ Concerto in C minor. Okay, and people like it. As a matter of fact, when I was teaching, I would take my kids there, and right after we were at the French Pavilion, I'd said, any of you want to go in again? I want to hear this. Well, no, they had other things on their mind, and I can understand that. But it is so important that in a world-class city such as this, and we think we are, if San Francisco has one, and if Kansas City has one, and Chicago has one, we think that Orlando should have an instrument such as this.
What about the thought that you spend a lot of money on an instrument such as the one that we're looking up on right now, and it's not something you might use, though, every time? If the orchestra plays, you're not always going to play an organ composition. So is the concern for the cost you put into it how frequently it would get used?
Well, that's very interesting, but I think if it's there, you use it. If we didn't have the organ in this cathedral, well, then we would use a piano, but because we have it. If we have an organ there, okay, let's use this. Let's try these compositions. We have several outstanding organists in this community. We feature in this cathedral a world-class organist every year, and they do in other churches downtown here.
You're listening to a special episode of Intersection, taped in downtown Orlando at the Cathedral Church of St. Luke. My guest is Turi Larson. I'm Mark Simpson. Do you think the new Performing Arts Center needs a new pipe organ? Tell us about it online, Facebook, and Twitter, or send email to intersection@wmfe.org. So talk to us a little bit about the organ here at the Cathedral Church of St. Luke in downtown. As we look up at it, what can you tell us about this organ?
Well, we think it's the finest organ in our community. It's an 88 rank. Now, when I say 88 ranks, that means 88 different colors, like oboe would be one rank, and clarinet, and bassoon, and the diapason, which is the basic organ tone, which doesn't represent anything other than the pipe organ. And
so you're saying it has a palette of 88 different tones?
Qualities of tone, yes. And you put them together, of course. You can have them singly or in ensembles together. And it just creates an environment and an aura of worship. And many people come to church to hear the organ.
And what about the various instrumental tones that the organ can produce?
Okay, we call those families of tones, just like in the orchestra. There are strings, woodwinds, brass, and percussion. We have the diapason, which is basic organ tone. And we have the strings. You have two sets of pipes, and one is just out of tune, just a little bit sharp or a little bit flat, and it sort of gives a waver. If you hear the orchestra tuning up and you don't hear this straight tone, you know they're out of tune. Well, we on purpose leave them with a different pitch so that it wavers and it gets that throbbing sound, and I can make lush strings on the organ. Then we have the brass. And the brass instruments in the orchestra are called reeds on the organ. So we have the soprano, reed, trumpet, and we have the French horn, the alto, we have the trombone, and then we have the tuba. And those go at various pitches. We have what we call a bombard, which is a big, fat tuba. That's a 32-foot. And then we have the flute quality of tone at 32 as well. And that's just a soft rumble. You more or less feel it more than you hear it.
Now, Tory Larson, you sent a letter to the op-ed section of the Orlando Sentinel that was published in June advocating for a pipe organ to be put in the Downtown Performing Arts Center. Now, have you gotten any kind of response?
Well, a gentleman just a block away from me stopped up when he was walking his dog, and he said, "Oh, it's exciting. I didn't know you were an organist, and I saw the article in there, and, oh, you have my support." And I felt good. When I went to the national convention, I spoke about it, and I had many organists tell me, you know, let us know more about it. We support this. And so they've had the opportunity to go online with this petition. We would wish for 25,000 names so that we could give it to the executive committee and say, look, we need to reconsider. And let me say that I say reconsider because initially, the acoustician and the architectural corporation thought about an organ because they put organs in. As a matter of fact, when I heard that there wasn't going to be an organ there, I said, oh, there isn't. That's too bad. And he said, well, if we were to put one in, and do you want to buy one? He said, if we were to put one in, it would be a Cassavant, which is a Canadian company, and they do outstanding jobs.
But you haven't had an official response yet from the Performing Arts Center organization regarding this yet?
No, we have not. And that's disappointing because we have petitioned them to meet with us. And they have said that even if the money is there, they are not interested. But we don't give up. And we think the public can rally around and give us the support so we can come to them with all of these names and so forth. We do have an action committee as part of our chapter. One of those people, Dr. Boyd Jones from Stetson, is on there. I have heard from Laura Ellis from the University of Florida. She thinks a community like this should have one.
We've been speaking with Turi Larson. He's former dean of the American Guild of Organists and also an organist at the Cathedral Church of St. Luke in downtown Orlando, where we've been speaking to him. Turi, so good to talk with you.
Thank you. My privilege being here.
We asked the management of the Performing Arts Center what they thought about possibly adding a pipe organ to the Dr. Phillips Performing Arts Center, and they wrote us back in a statement saying that their plan and budget do not allow for the inclusion of a concert organ, but their project team and developers conducted a thorough evaluation of the addition of a concert organ. They also point out, quote, beyond the cost of the organ itself, challenges include potential changes to the size of their rear tower, which could then impact the size of the rear stage, requiring significant cost and time for redesign. They point out that the center's neighbor, the First United Methodist Church of Orlando, houses a unique Aeolian Skinner Opus 1410 organ available for performances next door and is an ideal option for pipe organ performances in the immediate vicinity of the center. Take us out of the program, Turi Larson will perform the Bach Toccata and Fugue in D minor on Intersection. Conversation about what's happening in Florida continues online at the Florida Talks blog. Visit WMFE.org/intersection to find out more. There you can also sign up for our weekly podcast. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. Amy Green is assistant producer. I'm Mark Simpson, and thanks for listening.